everybody who's on the line for joining the Americans for Peace Now briefing call. It has been a very full and crazy week. I've been thinking of it as the good, the bad, and the ugly. I won't go through all of the events that occurred this week. I was going to do that, but I know that you've been following the events closely. I can't think of anyone better to analyze what's happened over the past week for us and the significance of those events than former Congressman Robert Wexler. I want to be sure to note that the former in front of congressmen was Robert Wexler's idea and not the voters, and he made that decision so he could devote himself full-time to issues of the Middle East and specifically Middle East peace. He does that currently as the president of the S. Daniel Abraham Center for Middle East Peace. The center does wonderful work, and we're very appreciative of the work that they do. Rob is a good friend of APN, even though we don't always agree with each other, and he is a good friend in the true sense of the word, friend of Israel. He's going to speak for about 10 or 15 minutes. He specifically wanted to leave more time for Q&A than for speech. So when he is done with his remarks, I will come back on. I'll give some instructions on how technically we'll proceed through the Q&A. These remarks and your questions and answers will be recorded for possible posting on our website. And at the end of the call, I've got some important announcements of some other events coming up, so I hope you'll stay on for the entire call. And I would now turn this over to Robert Wexler, and thank you for doing this for us, Rob.
My pleasure, and it goes without saying that it's a privilege and honor to be a part of any program with Americans for Peace Now, but particularly on this week, which has essentially been the World Series and the Super Bowl of the Israeli-Palestinian conflict all combined. And if we take a step back and try to extract from the president's two speeches, of course, his speech at the State Department and then at AIPAC, and Prime Minister Netanyahu's two speeches at AIPAC and the Congress today, what is it that we can take from the series of events? First and foremost, the president, in my humble opinion, made an exceedingly important statement. It wasn't radical. It wasn't groundbreaking, but nor was it unworthy or unnoteworthy as well, by signaling that it was America's position that the basis of negotiations between the Palestinians and the Israelis should be the 1967 lines with agreed territorial swaps, was, while again not radical, not a groundbreaking decision in terms of past administrations, but I think a very important statement about either revitalizing a moribund situation or, equally important, laying down a marker. What I think the president also said that I hope most in the American Jewish community can rally behind is his pronounced support for Israel as a Jewish state, as a homeland of the Jewish people. And I thought, remarkably so, was a few of the president's formulations that actually have not received a great deal of attention. I think we all understand that by saying the 1967 lines as a basis of negotiations with territorial swaps, that the president essentially is saying that upwards to roughly 80% of the Jewish Israelis who today live outside of the 1967 lines would be incorporated into the internationally recognized borders of the State of Israel. Likewise, the president said that Israeli withdrawal from the West Bank would be phased and that it would occur after the security performance of the Palestinians was demonstrated. Now, that's very broad language that can be interpreted obviously in many different ways. But, interestingly to me, on its surface is actually not inconsistent with the line or the articulation of Prime Minister Netanyahu today to the Congress, where he says that Israel's presence on the Jordan Valley, he no longer used the word permanent, but I think he used the word lengthy or something of that sort, lengthy duration. Again, there's room for compromise and room to actually accommodate the language of both of those positions. And most importantly, I think there's actually room, if there ever were to be negotiation, to narrow the difference between President Abbas and Prime Minister Netanyahu to some workable exchange. For those that have criticized the president and have employed the 2004 Bush-Sharon letter, I spoke at AIPAC twice yesterday, and I've done some speaking. And one of the arguments, because I think it's accurate and objective, that I've made is that if you take the totality of the 2004 Bush-Sharon letter and you take the totality of what President Obama has articulated in his two speeches, I would actually argue that President Obama took a position that was even closer to the ultimate position outlined by the Israeli government than did President Bush in 2004. Why do I say that? It is true that President Bush in his letter specifically said that the return of Palestinian refugees would be to the Palestinian state or somewhere other than Israel. In effect, President Bush said that. And it is true that President Obama said that the issue of refugees and the issue of Jerusalem should be handled after the issues of boundaries and security. But the truth is that when the president says that Israel will be a Jewish state and the homeland of the Jewish people, that is essentially mutually exclusive from there being a right of return, at least anything more than a nominal one, that is mutually exclusive from a right of return of Palestinian refugees to Israel. So by inference, if not even more specifically, the president in effect has said or laid down a marker that the right of return of Palestinian refugees will be to Palestine or to places other than the state of Israel. But what the president did that President Bush did not do, what President Obama did in his statements, is that he specifically outlined that the Palestinian state will be non-militarized, that, again, the withdrawal of the Israeli security forces will not only be phased, but phased based on a determination of performance by the Palestinians, which I think is a very significant marker. And what the president also did, which, again, seems to, in all the craziness surrounding the criticism of President Obama essentially debunked the entire Palestinian strategy of employing the United Nations in September for the purpose of creating a unilateral declaration of a Palestinian state. And in addition to that, I think in a very reasonable fashion, portrayed to the world the real makeup of Hamas, and he didn't sugarcoat it, and he said it like it is. And he legitimately asked the question, in essence, where he answered it, and said it's entirely unreasonable to expect that any state, and in this case Israel, negotiate with a party that calls for its destruction. And so if you take the president's comments in totality, I've been somewhat astonished that there has been associated with them the degree of controversy that we have seen. And let me stop with this. And I got in a great deal of trouble at AIPAC yesterday twice, I suspect less so on this call. But I was astonished, to say the least, in regard to Prime Minister Netanyahu's reaction, his original reaction to President Obama's speech, because I thought it would have been wiser both for Israel and for the American-Israeli relationship for Prime Minister Netanyahu to focus on the several aspects of President Obama's speech that, in fact, were at least consistent with the goals and objectives that Prime Minister Netanyahu had laid out. And he could have respectfully said, as to the formulation of the basis of negotiations that President Obama laid out, I may not agree with it in its entirety, but I stand ready, willing, and able to negotiate as soon as the Palestinians answer President Obama's question or call to determine for themselves who their negotiating partner is and make certain that they meet the standards that the international quartet has set out. So I was deeply disappointed in the way that Prime Minister Netanyahu originally framed his opposition to the president's statement, speech. But today's speech, I think, in fairness to Prime Minister Netanyahu, was framed very differently. I thought he took pains to make a bipartisan approach, and he fairly represented President Obama's position and, in fact, said at what point in the speech, a crucial point, I believe his language was, as President Obama said, the 1967 lines will be different after we negotiate, or that the agreement will be different than the 1967 lines, showing for the world, and particularly for Obama's detractors, that he, in fact, the president, never called for a return to the 1967 lines. So having said that, Deborah, I think maybe I should stop here.
Okay, so if you have a question, press star 6 and give us your name.
Hi, this is Sidney Topol. Can I ask a question, please?
Hi, Sid. Go right ahead.
This is Larry
Congressman Wexler. The question is, have you presented this point of view to your fellow former congresswoman or present congresswoman, Deborah Wasserman Schultz? Has she heard you making the points that you just made at this time? And if so, what is her reaction?
I'm going to answer the question in part. Debbie and I, as you can imagine, are good and close friends and allies, and we have known each other for a long time, well before either one of us even got to Congress. The answer is yes, I have. I'm not going, out of deference to her privacy, going to specifically share what she and I talked about in private. However, I am totally comfortable in saying that Debbie herself, and I think she put out a statement or two regarding the president's speech that may not have been quite as specific as the discussion I just had with you, but totally in line with that discussion. I could also tell you that yesterday in the Wall Street Journal I had a op-ed with a colleague of mine, Speaker Krieger, and that laid out this argument, I think, in fairly great detail, and I shared that with Debbie as well. And I'm also very confident to say that Debbie is a strong ally of the president. Forget me, I'm irrelevant, but is a strong ally of the president in every which way. And in this case, it's no different.
Thank you.
Okay,
next question. I actually think I heard Frank Bamberger start to ask a question when Sid did. So, Frank, if you did, you're on next. I guess I'm wrong. Okay, so star 6. Who would like to ask?
This is Frank Bamberger.
I'd like to ask a question. This is Len Schneiderman. Can you hear me?
Okay, Len, we'll go with you, and then Frank, I'm sorry, then it'll be you next. Len, go ahead.
Okay.
I'm trying to understand the Prime Minister's vantage point on the question of whether the status quo is sustainable. The sense I have is there's no sense of urgency on his part, some sense that the status quo is indefinitely sustainable. And what do you imagine that he imagines going forward to an uncertain future?
It's a great question, and I don't say that lightly. And I think anyone who tells you they have a good sense of the inner sense of Prime Minister Netanyahu and the direction that he's going is probably exaggerating a bit. I have my beliefs, and I have changed them at times. I'll be very candid. As I'm sure most everyone on the telephone call, I have known and been a part of discussions with the Prime Minister for a long period of time, both when he has been in power and when he has been outside of power. And while I at times have certainly taken exception with positions that he has taken throughout most of his tenure, and this is maybe where some would differ with me, I have consistently believed that there was, in fact, a formula or a prescription in which Prime Minister Netanyahu would act in a responsible and affirmative way to end the conflict with the Palestinians. Now, there have been times, candidly, in the recent past, where I've questioned my judgment. And I certainly was quite outraged, quite frankly, when I thought that the Prime Minister was misstating President Obama's position, possibly for his political domestic advantage. I think the Prime Minister dialed that back today, and he tried to recoup whatever tension there may have been created by the earlier interactions and the meeting between the President and the Prime Minister. But where his sense is today, well, I mean, putting his speech in the most positive light, it didn't provide hope, that's for sure. And it didn't create a new avenue in which to pursue negotiations. He didn't assist the process in that way. On the other hand, I don't think he impaired it. I think he did, in fact, provide a realistic statement of where he is. I think what we should do is actually read the Prime Minister's statements as the truth. And I think it's incumbent upon American diplomacy at this point to persuade President Abbas, putting aside the question of Hamas for the moment, but to persuade President Abbas to rely less on Prime Minister Netanyahu's statements and rely more on President Obama's statements, and the notion that we could possibly begin negotiations based on the 67 lines with territorial swaps, agreed swaps, that President Abbas be persuaded that to do so, in effect, is in the interest of the Palestinian people. Now, I'm not naive, and I'm not particularly wishful that this is going to happen, but that's what the direction I think we're left with. I don't think Prime Minister Netanyahu gave us a new avenue in which we can argue to President Abbas, oh, look what he gave you, so therefore you must come.
Okay, Frank Bamberger, you were trying to ask a question. Star 6.
Right. I think you can hear me.
Yes,
right?
We can. Yes.
Very good. Going back to or going forward to what you mentioned, Congressman, about the September meeting at the United Nations, there are voices. One that I would cite, Yossi Alfer. Do you know him?
I don't know. No, but I know of. I know of.
Yeah. I've known him a long time. He was a Mossad agent for, I think, 12 years. And he seems to think,
I think he's an astute observer. He seems to think that the negotiation path has played out and that it's necessary for the President Obama and the Prime Minister Netanyahu to focus on what can be gotten out of the United Nations in September as far as recognizing a Palestinian state. Is this a view that you dismiss? Or is a view that needs to be considered in all of this?
I think it would be an unproductive path. Number one, we need to decipher that a bit. We would need to distinguish between the United Nations General Assembly and the United Nations Security Council. And what would appear to be the strategy thus far for September is the General Assembly, and I do not have any confidence that the General Assembly would be in a position to offer up a plan or a way forward that would, in any realistic fashion, represent an opportunity. Now, the Security Council is a bit different because, of course, we, the United States, have a veto. But still, regardless of veto, not veto, which part of the United Nations, I genuinely think Netanyahu and Obama are correct in saying that there is no substitution for direct negotiations. And I guess that's where I would differ from the suggestion of the gentleman you referred to.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Sure.
Okay, next question.
Would I be talking here? Am I
yes.
being heard?
Yes, you are. Can you identify yourself?
Okay. Yes, I'm George Berge from Lancaster, Pennsylvania. And I just wanted to follow up on that last point in the sense that we have really, really always talked about what is good for the state of Israel. But the real question comes down to, isn't it true that the Palestinian people have a right to live in dignity, and that is impossible as long as they are subject to a cruel occupation, and that we need to find a way to get a viable Palestinian state together so that the two would be on an equal, nationally recognized basis of nation-against-nation discussions and not nation-against-colony? And I think it's very important that you do that through the United Nations because it's the United Nations that is going to determine its status as a recognized nation and a member state of the United Nations and give it some kind of equal footing in order to carry out these negotiations.
Well,
would you have a comment?
Yes. I mean, the general sentiment of Palestinian people deserving their dignity in the context of their political rights. You know, to me, that's not a debatable statement. It's universal in its correctness. The question is, though, and I think it's fair, is first off, who is the Palestinian state? Is it Fatah? Is it Hamas? Is it a unified country? Are there going to be elections, in fact? And are we doing this before the election results or after the election results? And I do think that Prime Minister Netanyahu does make a valid point in that, although I would go a bit further in terms of articulating the rights of the Palestinians, as much as we all want there to be a Palestinian state and a two-state solution that recognizes the sovereign rights of the Palestinians, and I would hope a state that consists of the amount of land equivalent to the West Bank and Gaza, that we have to be careful not to create either a failed state or a state that is predetermined in great part to be a state that is a, is at least in part a terrorist state. And I think these questions need to be answered. For instance, I don't think there's any realistic scenario that just because you declare a state that Israel is going to withdraw in any meaningful fashion its security positions. And so we're almost, that strategy in a certain way reminds me of the converse of Prime Minister Sharon's unilateral disengagement strategy. The goals may be quite proper, and the goals might be valid and laudable, but we're not going to reach them because if they're unilateral, the likelihood of success is probably not greater than zero.
Okay, next question, star six. Maybe while we have a brief, I'll, if the person who just unmuted their line would hold on one moment, I'm going to take the prerogative of the chair and I'm going to ask a question myself. Rob, as you know, we've been over the past few months very tough on the president because we felt he really needed to get much tougher on this issue and show his commitment not just in speech and but in actions as well. We were very pleased with his with all of the speeches that he made over this past week, and we applauded his comments. I'm wondering if you would comment now on what are the next steps, what are actions that can follow the speech. And I would say that for all of the players. We were significantly more disappointed in the Prime Minister's remarks before Congress today than you were, but I'm interested in what you see as the actions now that will follow all of these speeches.
Well, Deborah, that's a great question. And I first want to say, if I may, and it's not because we're on with your board and so forth. And I mean, there are times when I read some of the positions of Americans for Peace Now that, candidly, I may take a different posture to an extent. But the degree of credibility and integrity that Americans for Peace Now always, I don't know of an instance in my 14 or 15 years of knowing your positions, the degree of credibility and integrity that Americans for Peace Now provides for its positions, I think, is unmatched amongst any group. And while I have at times differed most recently with some of that pressure that you provided, I think that it was principled pressure, and I think not just me, anyone I would hope who's reasoned would respect that. For the same reasons, and I think you would agree more than anyone, for the same reasons that you applied that pressure, now I would argue you should support what the president has articulated, because to the degree you may have been frustrated or disappointed, I think, I hope, that most people will agree that the president more than stood up, and given the I think, somewhat irrational criticism that he's received, he certainly created a firestorm, and those of us who are at least in great agreement with the president need to really stick our necks out here now in support of what he's attempting to do. But your question is, okay, now what? And
yeah.
Unfortunately, I think some of the most valid criticism, although, actually, I wouldn't even call it criticism. I think one of the most valid observations regarding what has occurred thus far is that the president did not seem to provide an implementation strategy. And so what do we do? Now, they are unconnected but connected, and what I'm referring to is Senator Mitchell's resignation from his position as envoy, and the, at least for the short term, the administration's decision not to replace Senator Mitchell but to elevate his deputy, that is, I think, one indication that the administration is not gung-ho on entering into some kind of major push. Likewise, the president didn't denounce, for instance, that Secretary Clinton would be visiting the region in the near future to implement his vision. That would have been an indication of great interest or something of that nature. Nor did the president announce that he was going to attend President Peres's presidential conference in Jerusalem at the end of June. So there were different things that the president could have articulated that would have signaled a direct engagement by the administration in an aggressive fashion, and that at least was not outlined for the short term, which I think reflects a sense of reality in the administration, the dual reality that, you know, listen, this president has a lot of things on his plate. We've got to draw down our forces in Iraq in a rational and sober and stable way. There are enormous challenges still yet in Afghanistan. The killing of Osama bin Laden has presented a whole new set of revisions, possibly, in our policy towards Pakistan, certainly a review. And most importantly, if Mr. Daley is doing his job correctly, which I know he is, he's going to say to the president, you know, that was really terrific what you did on the Israelis and the Palestinians. But, Mr. President, you know, we're still in danger of $4 a gallon gasoline and going higher to $5, and we've got to pay attention to jobs in Indiana and Ohio, and, you know, everyone understands the economy is the issue. So the implementation, I think President is letting this settle, but I think in the very short term there needs to be serious conversations with the Palestinian side and a understanding of whether or not Mr. Abbas is still interested in negotiations. And I say that with utmost respect to Mr. Abbas. I sat at AIPAC yesterday and argued for a long period of time the question of, is there a peace partner for the Israelis? And received all kinds of criticism for arguing that Mr. Abbas, under any reasonable definition, was a peace partner for the Israelis, and that, of course, the unity agreement puts that in abeyance in terms of our understanding relative to American law what the situation is. But even so, we need to know from Mr. Abbas what it is, in fact, that will bring him back to the negotiation table. His public statements of late have not been helpful. His article in the New York Times did a disservice to himself. If I understand it correctly,
that was a very forthcoming article.
Whoever is speaking other than Rob Wexler, please mute your line. *6. Sorry, Rob. Continue.
No, that's okay. I just would, you know, Mr. Abbas most recently seemed to call for a 3-month settlement freeze that might enable him to get back to the table. And I'm not an advocate of Prime Minister Netanyahu's policies, but I think at this point, given that the President Obama, has stuck his neck out in a domestic political sense, that it would be wise, I would argue, for President Abbas to, in reference to the president, not the prime minister, but in reference to the president has offered him a, I think, golden opportunity by indicating that negotiations should be based on the 67 lines with land swaps. I cannot imagine a president of the United States offering President Abbas or the Palestinian leadership a bigger, more opportunistic opening. And yes, he may have every right and reason to doubt Prime Minister Netanyahu's credibility or his commitment to a legitimate, earnest process, but he doesn't have reason to doubt President Obama's, I don't think, at this point. And I think he should take up President Obama on his call, and he and Ernest should try to figure out a formula with the president, not the prime minister at the beginning, with the president, on how President Abbas can come back to the table with his integrity and dignity intact. And I think that conversation needs to occur. And if the president concludes that there is an opportunity, then I would respectfully suggest that the Secretary of State weigh in a significant way. And if not, then we have to let the dust settle.
Okay, thank you. Next question, star six.
Deborah, it was the other chair who bowed to your prerogative as a chair, Martin Bressler.
This is Martin Bressler. He's the chair of Americans for Peace Now.
Great.
I wonder, Rob, if you would speculate, and I know it's speculation, on the political fallout here in the United States of the events of the last week. Has this been good for President Obama? Has this made more enemies for him or doubters? How do you think it's going to play out politically in terms of the 2012 election?
Well, I think to President Obama's credit, he did not make a decision either to speak about the issue or what to say about the issue based on a political calculation to his credit. But that's not your question. If I can share an experience of mine, I had the privilege of representing a district in South Florida, which more likely than not had more Jewish Americans in it than any other district in the country. And I remember very distinctly at the time that we were preparing to go to war in Iraq. And you may remember, of course, the declaration that gave President Bush the authority to go to war. At the time, Prime Minister Sharon sat on the lawn of the White House and pointed into the White House and said, "That president, Mr. Bush, is the most pro-Israel president we've ever experienced." And I think Shimon Peres visited either right before or right after and essentially said the same thing. And for all intents and purposes, most, if not all, not all, but most of the major Jewish American organizations endorsed or implicitly endorsed the war in Iraq. I voted for the resolution to give President Bush the authority to go to war. And I didn't do so based on a political calculation. However, I must tell you it was the most unsuccessful political vote that I ever cast. And it was most unsuccessful within the Jewish community that I was privileged to represent. People, not you, but I think the media and observers make generalizations about the American Jewish community all the time that I think are off base. To this day, American Jews are the most opposed to the war in Iraq of any other groupings of Americans. And what I always find astonishing, not now, but at the time, Saddam Hussein was paying $25,000 to each suicide bomber and so forth. And even so, the Jewish American community, to its credit, I say this with respect, the sense of context and the sense of what's best for America, the nation, and the weighing of the worthiness of a war versus the cost of the war, all of these different factors, I think, are plus others, very seriously considered. With respect to President Obama and the Jewish community, no doubt that many of the loudest voices are those that seem to have a great exception with President Obama. But what I find in the American Jewish community is that there really is a silent majority on many of these issues. And I think there is a, not necessarily silent, but a significant vast majority of Jewish Americans who appreciate that President Obama's goal is a secure, strong, Jewish, and democratic Israel. And they acknowledge the fact that a perpetual occupation, a continued occupation, is neither in Israel's interest or America's, and that it will take American leadership to resolve the problem. And there will be 25% or some number that scream bloody murder, but I think there is a rational majority. And so I think the president will do well. And when all is said and done, of course, and you don't do this, but as I think we all appreciate, the American Jewish community is not a one-issue community, and American Jews care deeply about health care issues and education issues and all of the issues that other Americans do. And on those issues, the vast majority of them, President Obama's prescription is certainly more in line with the Jewish community than will his opponents be. So I think the president will do well, but I also think to rest on past laurels would be a bad formula as well. We're going to have to go out, those of us who support the president, and earn every Jewish vote, just like we did in the original election. And I was with the president very early on, and the frustrating part for me, I'm sure not for President Obama, but for me, is whereas the Jewish American Jewish community oftentimes gives benefit of the doubt to a number of people, this president doesn't seem to get the benefit of the doubt very often. And I think like one example is I often hear the criticism, well, the president hasn't gone to Israel yet. And President Bush didn't go to Israel till his seventh or eighth year. But I don't ever remember anyone saying President Bush hasn't gone to Israel yet.
Okay, hello? We have time for hello? One more question. Star 6.
I have a question.
Okay, and identify yourself. The woman who spoke.
Yes. This is Marcia Peck calling from San Diego, and I just wanted to address the what was termed irrational criticism, which I agree with. And for so long, Jewish Middle East peace organizations have been going to Washington to lobby Congress to take a more moderated view of the Middle East peace process than that presented by AIPAC. And the Republicans now appear to be using the Obama 67 border statement politically in terms of the upcoming election. Will this set this process of education back?
It has the great potential to do so. I agree with you, and it's deeply troubling. It's deeply troubling because it's based on a false premise, of course, which is President Obama did not call for negotiations based on the 1967 lines. He called for negotiations based on the 1967 lines with agreed territorial swaps, which is an entirely different equation. Now, I wish, and this is not a criticism, but I wish the president had provided greater context in his original speech like he did at the speech at AIPAC, and maybe we could have avoided some of the controversy. But in fairness to the president, I really don't think this is caused by any inadequacies in his speech. I think it's most likely caused by purposeful misrepresentation by political opponents and others in the response. And so the great danger, of course, and you referenced it in part, is that whereas in the past support for Israel has largely been on a bipartisan basis and partisanship has raised its specter infrequently, I think we are likely to begin a political season where Israel and our policy towards Israel is presented in a far more partisan vein, and that's not good for anybody who cares about the American-Israeli relationship. And that's what's so mystified me, disturbed me in terms of some of the original comments by Prime Minister Netanyahu, because I unfortunately think he may have added to that firestorm.
Okay, so before I make final announcements, I want to thank all of you for your very important and well-thought-out questions. I really want to thank Robert Wexler. I started this call by saying that I could not think of anyone who could better analyze the events of the past week, and I end with the same statement. So, Rob, I really appreciate your time and
my
your
pleasure.
Thoughts. And as always, your wisdom, and thank you for your generous comments about Americans for Peace Now as well.
It's true.
Thanks,
thank
Rob.
You.